From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Young Latinos in Georgia are suffering from an increase in bullying.
And you have to add to that that Latina girls in Georgia have the highest suicide attempt rate in the state and one of the highest in the nation. Many studies tell us that is 1 out of 5. That is outrageous.
That's ahead, plus how some Georgia schools are trying to recruit more Latino teachers. First, though, yesterday Dylan Thompson gave us one student's view of drinking culture at the University of Georgia in Athens.
A question that I hear a lot on weekends is, you know, are you going out tonight? What are you doing? And that's always the first question. It's not really, what are you doing? It's, are you going to the bars or are you not going to the bars?
Dylan Thompson's a senior at UGA and writes for the Red and Black newspaper. Here are your first thoughts, Sue, in Athens.
I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. There are well over 100 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in the Athens area, which means that we have a great many people who have problem with alcohol, or we wouldn't need to have so many meetings. There's a lot more I could say. I'm a University of Georgia graduate, went to school there in the 70s, and I don't think the problem so much is alcohol. The problem is accountability. We have to find a way for people to know that they're, as adults, as young adults, that they're accountable and responsible.
Hi, my name is Alex Mowry. I'm from Athens, Georgia. I'm a student here at UGA. There's actually an organization here on campus that is student-run, and it's a really popular organization. It's called Phi Flam, where the students throw these huge parties that thousands of students come to that are completely dry in order to combat the binge drinking and partying scene in Athens.
We love hearing stories like this. You can call us like Alex did and also Sue and let us know what you think. It's 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. 100 years ago, the United States entered into World War I.
Inside the White House, President Woodrow Wilson conferred with advisors, then signed the Proclamation of War against Germany. Headlines told the story to the people of America.
A new exhibit at the Atlanta History Center highlights Georgia's connection to the conflict. Like the red poppy, it is fire truck red with its petals, black center, and it's become an international symbol of the human cost of war. Many don't know the red poppy actually rose to prominence, though, thanks to former University of Georgia professor Moina Michael. Michael's featured in the Atlanta History Center's exhibit. Sue Verhoff is the center's director of oral history and genealogy, and it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
So Michael, is kind of an interesting person that I don't think I had never heard of, for sure. But it sounds like she had a immediate connection to World War I because she was there in Europe when it broke out and almost immediately started into service in helping people who were stranded.
She was. She was visiting there in July of 1914, and her tour group, the group leader, sort of shepherded her group down to Rome, where they worked at the embassy to help other stranded Americans secure passage back to the United States. It was a scary time for everyone, and she got provided that help early on.
We're going to get to the red poppy in just a little bit, but we kind of have to follow Moina and her journey to that moment, because she came back to Georgia. She started teaching at the University of Georgia, but she started volunteering at the YMCA, and many people may not realize that the YMCA is not a gym and a swimming pool, as many people know it now. During World War I, it actually served a pretty important purpose.
Yes, and did in World War II as well. YMCA was extremely important. She wanted to volunteer. She was older. She was not trained as a nurse, and she was not trained as a mechanic, so she couldn't do many of the things that other women, American women, did in France and did overseas. But she did volunteer for the YMCA and was trained in Columbia University, for secretarial and administrative tasks and hostessing tasks to help servicemen.
Which means she came in contact with a lot of servicemen and soldiers that were either serving in the war or had served in the war, because they were passing through the YMCA.
She did, and she did at UGA as well. They had a reception area there that she worked at And so she that happened at UGA as well, seeing these soldiers as they met with their families and said goodbye to their families before they left to serve overseas.
So what do we know? Do we have any relics left behind? Because she at that point, she sees a ladies' home journal and sees the picture, which I'm going to have you describe in a minute. But do we have any idea of her thought process and why she was so affected by this?
She wrote very directly about the experience in her autobiography. So that was a very crystalline moment in her life. It was a spiritual experience. And yes, she writes very directly about how that worked.
She opens the Ladies' Home Journal. She sees a picture of what?
It was dropped on her desk by a soldier, actually. And when the office cleared out and she had a few minutes to read it, she opened it up to a dog-eared page that had a copy of Colonel John McCrae, the Canadian physician, who wrote the poem that at that time was known as We Shall Not Sleep.
Now it's often known as
In Flanders Fields, exactly. And it was illustrated, this beautiful illustration of the red poppies at the bottom of the illustration among the crosses, the larks flying among the artillery shells and debris, and these soldiers, many of them with treated wounds, rising from the ground and ascending towards the heavens. It's a beautiful illustration.
And it seemed to have been the poppies that stuck in her head. In fact, she wrote a poetic response to McCrae's poem. We recorded just a little bit of it. The poem that she wrote was called We Shall Keep the Faith, and here's one stanza.
We cherish, too, the poppy red that grows on fields where valor led. It seems to signal to the skies that blood of heroes never dies, but lends a luster to the red of the flower that blooms above the dead in Flanders fields.
So it could have been just a momentary or even a longer-lasting emotional moment for her, but why did she want to make the red poppy more of a symbol for everyone?
She worried that when the war was over with, that the posters and all of the visual representations of the war that had been plastered everywhere to unite the United States behind this war effort, once those left, that people would forget. That they would forget the sacrifices that were made. And the response to the image and to the poem was so visceral for her that she determined that the poppy needed to be the symbol, that was the symbol that needed to be created.
So then how did that actually happen? Because she was very successful in working this through. What happened next?
It was. At the time that she finished writing that poem on the back of an envelope, three gentlemen came in from one of the training sessions to give her a check for $10. She had been providing flowers to brighten up the office spaces, and they were grateful for that, and they wanted to reimburse her for that. And when she got that check, she immediately said, "This is what I'm going to do with it. I am going to go down, and I'm going to buy red poppies, artificial poppies, and I'm going to hand them out to everyone who'll take one." She didn't realize how tough it would be to find artificial poppies in New York City in November, but she did manage to find some at Wanamaker's department store. And as she talked with the sales clerk about why she was looking for these things, the sales clerk told her, "Well, my brother was just killed in World War I, and he is one of those men that are sleeping underneath those poppies in Flanders Fields." And she felt like that was just a sign. So she brought the poppies back, handed them out to everyone who would take them. And then really her efforts, her untiring efforts to promote this. She wrote to her congressman. She spoke at women's groups. She spoke at veterans groups. She did everything she could to promote this as a symbol of remembrance.
And it has become an international symbol. In fact, they just I think it was last year or maybe the year before, the Tower of London featured an art exhibit with red poppies like a sea pouring out of the window.
Yes.
What does the red poppy mean now?
It still is a symbol of remembrance. But beyond the symbol of remembrance, it's a method for collecting funds to be able to help surviving veterans and their families. When she went back to UGA to teach, many of the students that she taught were veterans who came back with either physical or mental wounds. And she wanted to be able to do something to help them. And the idea came to have them create these artificial poppies that could then be sold. So by the time she died in 1944, the sale of the poppies by the American Legion that adopted it as a symbol in 1920 had raised $200 million to benefit veterans.
And what do you have of hers in the exhibit at the Atlanta History Center?
There are two photographs of her in the exhibition, a portrait of her and then also a picture of her at the New York City location with her fellow workers around her.
And probably some red poppies.
Oh, yes. Yes.
That is Sue Verhoff. She is the Director of Oral History and Genealogy at the Atlanta History Center. Sue, it's a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When the poppies bloom again, I'll remember you.
More than 100,000 men and women from Georgia served in World War I. One of them was Roland Neal of Macon. Lieutenant Neal received the Distinguished Service Cross for extraordinary heroism in action. He shared his memories in a 1975 interview with the Macon Telegraph. He remembered exactly how long he was deployed.
17 months and 2 weeks.
And recalled a terrifying moment with co-pilot Hank.
I had felt this bullet come through the floor of the plane. Now we were flying perfectly straight. Then I looked further, and the bullet had continued right on up and hit the elevator wire and completely cut it in two.
The two had to think fast if they wanted to make it out alive. Hank suggested crash landing in a tree. Roland's response?
I said, hell no, let's try to ride it out. He said, all right now, listen carefully, do what I said, do. I said, Hank, what are you going to do? He said, don't worry, I'm going to get you back to that little blue-eyed southern girl. He had seen my wife's picture on my dresser.
Determined to get back to Macon, Roland followed Hank's instructions to take a seat and wrap the plane's elevator wire around his glove. When Roland pulled the wire, the plane started climbing. They managed a perfect landing. Roland came back to Georgia, but his brother didn't. Joseph Neal Jr. died just a few weeks before the Great War ended. Roland remembered his brother's compassion.
He got orders one morning to go over and take prisoners at Sommy Hill. And Joe called all his boys together and said, now look, don't kill these Germans. We want them alive. Bring them back alive.
When his company came under attack, a piece of shrapnel struck Joseph in the head.
He didn't have a chance. If we could have gotten that lead out, he would have been an imbecile the rest of his life. He lived 36 hours.
That was Roland Neal, veteran of World War I. The Macon native spoke in 1975 to the Macon Telegraph. He died in 1982. That audio comes from the Library of Congress. Just ahead, Georgia needs more Latino teachers. But first, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of sex abuse in doctor's offices. This is On Second Thought. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. A note for listeners, the next conversation is about sexual abuse, and it may not be appropriate for all ages. This week, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution was named a Pulitzer Prize finalist for its investigation of thousands of doctors across the country. Reporters discovered a disturbingly high number of medical professionals have sexually abused their patients with little or no repercussions. Ariel Hart and Danny Robbins were two of the reporters that worked on the series. Welcome back.
Hey. Hello, Celeste.
Hello, it's good. We haven't had Ariel talking about this before. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
First, let's talk about how this, let's go back a little bit, Ariel, to how this all began and when you and the and other reporters began looking into allegations of sexual abuse in medical offices.
Well, this really grew out of Danny's work. He was looking at another doctor, and just out of an abundance of rigor, he requested records from the Georgia Medical Board on physicians. And he just noticed something odd, which was all of these doctors who had been disciplined for sexual misconduct seemed to be getting their licenses back. And so the paper decided to look into that further.
And what you found, Danny, was shocking, first of all, but the reporting in and of itself was difficult because of the nature of the abuse. I want to play this comment from David Clossy, who oversees SNAP. That's an advocacy group for people who have been sexually abused by priests and doctors and other figures of authority. He spoke with you and the rest of the AGC reporters for the series, and he's talking about how difficult it is to get victims to come forward.
I think if you haven't experienced sexual exploitation or violence, it's really hard to understand how and why it's so devastating. You know, there is no more deeply personal betrayal than this, because it's a betrayal on a physical and an emotional level and psychological level all at the same time.
How hard was it for you to get people to go on the record?
Some harder than others, but some were very willing to talk. The thing about this story, Celeste, is many of these people were victimized multiple times, first by a doctor and then by the system. The system would let them down because the doctor would remain in practice. And it was interesting, many of the people, a lot of these victims were sort of hidden away. We found them through the documents we looked at, and then we would approach them, and I was surprised at the number of victims who would say, well, he's in prison, or he's in jail, right? And then you would say, no, he's not. And many of them were willing to be forthcoming because they were so angry at the way the system had treated them after they had come forward.
And Ariel, this is one of the things we talked about before, how difficult it is actually to discipline doctors, because in many cases, as I understand, not only were the doctors not put in jail, but many of them retained their licenses, correct?
Many of them retained their licenses. And we will say, we may only know the tip of the iceberg of cases, because there's this vast infrastructure of secret, not even discipline, but secret dealing with this issue that has grown up with medical boards. And I think it's highly possible that the vast majority are now dealt with secret orders, so that if for the specific purpose of not endangering the practice of these doctors. But yes, the ones that we were able to look at, overall, half retained their licenses, and in Georgia, about two-thirds retained active
right.
licenses.
One of the doctors, one of the cases you talk about in the series is the case of Dr. Andrew Deakel of Cairo, Georgia, sentenced to 4 years in prison. So there's one who actually got sentenced. He was trading prescriptions for sexual favors, but he regained his license. One of the patients who testified at his trial was a woman named Cindy Sheridan.
To be abused by a husband and then turn around and be abused by my doctor, you know, it was a double whammy. This was like in a five-year period. I would try so hard to detox at home so I wouldn't have to go to him. But I always ended up going back.
And I want to play this other comment. This is Kim Johnson, who was both a nurse and a patient of Andrew Deakel, and she defends him.
Dr. Deakel will be honest, and he'll say, I did stupid stuff, and I got in trouble, and, you know, that's how we learn. He didn't go out there looking for it. It came to him. Yes, that's where he crossed the line, and he was wrong, but he paid his price. And he has proven to everyone in the community, to everyone here, he's here for good.
Why is it so difficult to remove a license of a doctor? Why is it so hard to take away a doctor's license or their access to patients if they have committed sexual assault or sexual abuse in the past?
Well, one thing, the context for that story, there's only a very small handful of states, and I think it's four, five, or six, where a felony for sexual misconduct means you cannot practice medicine.
Right.
Georgia is one where that's not does not prohibit it. It's all done on an ad hoc basis. So a doctor can go in there, make his case, two other doctors basically on the medical board, and you don't know. A lot of it's done behind closed doors in committees where, look, I'm in a small town. I want to help these people and make a case. But when you go back and look at a case like Dr. Deakle, there are people who feel like he's a great doctor in that small town. But someone like Cindy Sheridan is seriously addicted to drugs, and he used that to for sexual gratification. And the Georgia Bureau of Investigation did their investigation on him, found close to 400 photos of female patients in his office, nude photos of women who had posed in exchange for the drugs. So you have to look at both sides. But in answer to your question, doctors judging other doctors, not wanting to lose that someone who is in that profession,
and then they don't want to set a precedent either.
It's deference. And another point is doctors have the ability to have the best lawyers, maybe more than other people, and then those lawyers will go in and negotiate with the medical board. It's a system with various pieces in it, but the ultimate end game is they continue to practice or lose their license and then come back.
And I would add to that the whole system is really set up on behalf of the doctors. The boards see themselves as the patient's advocate, but the way the system is set up really redounds to the benefit of the doctors. First of all, a lot of states, the doctors argue that their medical license is a property right. So that starts this whole legal parameter.
Not a privilege, but a right,
exactly. And you can see, like, in medical canons and medical ethics going back for centuries, the ability to practice medicine is always talked about as a privilege, but that's not what they argue when they go to court and they win. And so the patients are never given the ability to go into court and say, well, my right not to be violated is a right too, that that ought to counterbalance this. That kind of balance never happens. It's always the doctor versus the state. And the other thing is that the laws, you don't have this big infrastructure of patients' rights lobbies. You have a massive infrastructure of doctors' rights lobbies. You've got the American Medical Association, and then more importantly, the individual state medical associations that have well-paid lobbyists going in to battle for protections for doctors against patients, against accusations. And all of that creates a system where a doctor is really protected when they go in against a board.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporters Ariel Hart and Danny Robbins. They're part of the team that investigated medical doctors who were accused of sexual abuse, and that series was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. And I didn't say congratulations, so congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
We got straight into the nitty-gritty here. You guys spoke with William Allman. Dr. William Allman, about his past and the accusations of sexual misconduct that were made against him over the years. Here's just a portion of what he told you.
I enjoy being a physician. What I don't enjoy is feeling like I have to look over my shoulder because once you have one complaint, there is a target on your back. People looked into these things. It was investigated by all the authorities, and what happened. And I accepted that. And I have gone on. That's where I am right now.
So two things here. Danny, tell me about Dr. William Allman first, and then we'll get to why I'm not quite convinced that the past seems to follow these doctors around, because it seems like it's kind of difficult, actually, for patients to find out about this history. But tell me about his specific case.
Well, absolutely. These were three very, very different charges in three very different settings. He was... He left the military after he was accused of sexual misconduct with a patient, and then that was at Fort Gordon, and then he went to work part-time as the doctor at the Augusta Jail. He was again accused of sexual misconduct there. He was actually charged and arrested there. The charges ultimately were dropped. But there were issues about the exams he gave those women. So he was penalized again by the medical board. Then he came over to the Atlanta area and worked for Wellstar in Paulding County. Again, women complained, and there he was charged again. He ultimately pled guilty to sexual battery. But one of the charges against him was actually involved a minor. And and the medical board still did. Usually they'll take your license temporarily. In his case, they didn't. He was one of several doctors we found with multiple cases in multiple places with victims who never knew each other, who were still practicing medicine as they kind of went from place to place.
But one of the things that he describes here, Ariel, is this feeling like he's followed around by his past. But through your reporting, it sounds to me like it's actually quite difficult for a patient to find out.
It's incredibly difficult. And that's one of the things that really stuck out to us is that secrecy is used as leverage by the boards, by hospitals, by everyone who deals with these doctors. Look, just get off of our staff and we won't tell anyone. One hospital CEO said to me, he was talking about basically how proud he was at having gotten a doctor to leave who he knew molesting patients. And he said to me, well, would you have left that grenade sitting in your house? And I said, no, but on no account would I have rolled it into my neighbor's house. And he had just never thought of it that way. Patients who want to find out about their doctors, who among us ever thought, go on the medical board website for your state and look for the database of board orders. Even if you're that smart, you're not going to see the wealth of information that never makes it to a board order because there are secret orders, because a doctor successfully argues his case, because they negotiate the order down to the vaguest possible terms, because they can't even find it on the board website. And in the case of William Ahman, that was Danny's reporting, and he's got a massive amount of reporting on this guy with horrific detail, to the extent that I happened to run into a colleague of Dr. Ahman's at a conference, and she was livid that we were even looking into it because she had no idea herself. She was a colleague of this guy. She had no idea what he had done.
And I would just emphasize, in his case and all the others that I looked at, with multiple victims, the victims never knew each other. In fact, in Dr. Ahman's case, the two that came forward at Wellstar, one was a 40-year-old woman, one was a 16-year-old girl who had seen him on different occasions, had no clue who the others were until at the very end. And we looked at another case at the University of Wisconsin Hospital with four women who came forward around the same time. No connection. The target may exist in some places, but in the cases we looked at, that was not what we saw.
I want to emphasize why it took the amount of dedication and resources on the AJC's part to look into this, because it is difficult to get this information. Here is Josh Riley. He's a detective with the Wilmington Police Department in Ohio. He handled a case of sexual abuse by a doctor, and he says in the end, let's let him describe it.
It's difficult when you have a physician and a patient in a room with no cameras, no nurses, no one else, and they do something of a sexual nature, say something, ask for something, or just flat out do something, and there's no witnesses and there's no way of proving it. You are down to he said, she said, she said, he said. How do we prove it?
How much is that made even more difficult by the fact that in addition to all of the normal difficulties of a sexual assault case, you have a doctor who's well-respected and then a patient who is often not?
And you have examinations where you're sitting there and vulnerable, and a male doctor and a female patient in a gown. And
they're supposed to touch you.
Yes. And so many of the people we talked to, did this really happen to me? Is what you also heard. So it's a situation where they're set up like this. In the case that Josh Riley was talking about, a woman went back in with a tape recorder to get him to say some things. And even then, they weren't sure what they can do. This is a small town in Ohio. They ultimately had another woman read about the case in the paper, came forward and had DNA. But the reason we focused on that case was they said, look, we wouldn't have been able to do anything without this DNA because these were in closed door examinations, the women's word against a doctor who was a respected person in the community.
In the minute we have left, Ariel, is the reporting continuing?
The reporting is continuing. The really full-on effort, the main project, concluded at the end of the year. But as we continue to see impact from the project, we've been very gratified to see a few states really take the results to heart and try and do something within their legislatures. We're continuing to report on that.
That is Ariel Hart of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and we spoke with Danny Robbins as well, both reporters who were part of the team that investigated medical doctors who have been accused of sexual abuse. That series was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. So again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks so much to both of you. Just ahead, where are all the Latino teachers in Georgia? You're needed. First, though, the rise in bullying against Latino teens. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Tomorrow, we'll take another look at Georgia's 6th District congressional race ahead of Tuesday's election. We'll talk about why the seat is so important and whether attack ads against Democratic candidate John Ossoff are ethical. And we want you to join this conversation. Have you ever been convinced by an attack ad? Do you think they're effective? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message or post on Facebook. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning. Latino youth are being harassed and bullied more since the November presidential election. That's according to some recent surveys. But the Georgia Department of Education says it has not received complaints about bullying of Latino students since the election. I spoke about this last month with Andy Miller, editor of Georgia Health News. Also, Belisa Urbina, executive director of Ser Familia, which provides counseling and other services to Hispanic families in the metro Atlanta area. Andy, why the discrepancy in numbers between this report saying that there's an uptick and the Department of Education saying there isn't?
Well, that's a very good question, Celeste. I think that it may be that the safety hotline run by the Department of Education isn't very well known to folks in schools, or because the surveys and the actual people on the ground are saying that this is happening.
And, Melissa, is this what you are also hearing from the people that you interact with, that there has been an uptick?
Yes, certainly. This is what we hear every day from parents and students as well.
What kind of bullying are they talking about?
They are talking about telling students, you know, racial slurs, destroying property in school, harassing kids, you know, posting messages in Facebook. So it has gotten really bad. Bad enough that I have heard so many parents tell us that they don't want to send the kids to school.
Is this bullying coming from other students for the most part?
For the most part, it's other students. But you also see, like yesterday, we had a family at the office in which they have had to post, went to the police and put a temporary protection order against a neighbor.
Andy, why is this a health care matter?
Well, the victims of bullying, Celeste, tend to have more mental health problems. They lose self-esteem. They lack confidence. And other very major effects in terms of their education. I mean, they don't go to school as often, and you know, the effect of bullying can be very, very difficult to accept or to kind of take in, especially for younger children.
But this is an issue. If it is true that there's just a lack of awareness about this hotline, so people aren't using it, and yet bullying affects so severely a kid's outcomes at school, that would seem to me to be a problem for the Georgia Department of Education.
I think what's happening, Celeste, is it's a school-by-school thing. In other words, the people at the state level are not as involved as what's happening on the ground at each particular school. And I think the principal is really the change agent here. He or she can really set the tone for inclusion or just kind of letting things go as they normally go. And that's the person, I think, at the school level is where you see more reports of this, and maybe they don't filter up to the actual state government level.
How do you counsel parents and students to handle this when they come to you? Do you find that the schools are being proactive in handling these kind of reports?
Some of them are and some of them are not. You know, we have received many calls from principals. I agree with what Andy is saying. And we also have gotten, you know, several calls from parent liaisons on the ground level that they are concerned about the issues. And I even had a principal call me 1 week right after the election and says, this has gotten so bad that some days I just think, you know, I just should send everybody home and just let it cool for a couple of days. So normally what we tell parents and students is find ways to just voice their what is going on, make the principal responsible for, you know, addressing the situation, because there's only so much that the parents can do. And then working with the self-esteem and communication skills at home.
Andy, studies show that Latino kids here in our state have among the highest rates of depression and anxiety of any in the state or even the country. But that existed also. It may have gotten worse since November, but that existed before the presidential election as well. Do we have any idea why?
I think it's the dynamic of these kids. They have these situations at home where it might be, the kids are born here, they're U.S. citizens, but it might be a parent or an uncle or a cousin that is here undocumented. And so there's all sorts of anxiety and tensions that go along with that. Plus, you have the recent crackdown by the Trump administration on immigration, and so it's probably just exacerbated from that point.
Do you have other things to add in terms of why there are these high rates of depression and anxiety among Latino youth?
Sure, and you have to add to that Latina girls in Georgia have the highest suicide attempt rate in the state and one of the highest in the nation. Many studies tell us that is 1 out of 5. That is outrageous. Part of it also has to do...
1 out of 5 young Latino women in the state commit attempt suicide at some point.
Yes, ma'am.
If you're just joining us, I am speaking with Belisa Urbina. She's executive director of Ser Familia. Also, Andy Miller, who is editor for Georgia Health News. We're talking about reports that there's been an uptick in bullying of Latino students. So, Belisa, if something occurs between two students, this is the problem with bullying of any kind, right? That it then becomes a he said, she said problem. So is there something the state is not doing that it could do to cut down on these incidents of bullying and also the impact that it has?
I think that, you know, part of the problem is that many times we think, oh, this is a Latino problem. What we have seen for years is that Latino students in a school, they are treated like they are different. So many times, you know, they don't intervene in the situations. The problem is, like Andy said, 85 to 90% of our Latino young people are U.S. citizens or permanent residents. They are here to stay. If we don't allow them to get, you know, better outcomes. And when I say better outcomes, it's not giving them the chance to go to college. It's working on their family relationships and self-esteem. But even the state and the schools, they don't have resources. Many times I get calls from the school sending their students to us. You know, none of the community service boards that are mandated to deal with mental health in the metro area have anybody that speaks Spanish. No counselors, no psychiatrists. Many of the health systems don't have any psychiatrists that speak Spanish. They don't have counselors either. None of the domestic violence safe houses have bilingual counselors on staff. So the very few agencies that provide mental health in Spanish end up getting all of those clients. To give you an idea, for every person that we admit on our mental health counseling program, we have 3 to 4 waiting for a space. So the demand is outrageous, and there is very little that schools or anybody is doing to help these Latino young people.
Andy, is it fair to say that we don't actually know why there has been an uptick of bullying among Latino youth? I mean, it's occurred, they say the increase occurred since the November presidential election, but that doesn't mean we know why.
Well, you're right. And basically, you know, the president ran his campaign on building a wall and tough immigration policy and things like that. And I think that the atmosphere that we see in our politics is that there's a lot of division, there's a lot of hate, And all that kind of bubbles up, and we're seeing the effects of that in schools. I also want to say that Muslim kids are also targeted in some cases.
Although we don't yet have statistics on an incidence of bullying.
That's correct.
How is the state responding, if it is responding at all, to this report, to these reports showing an increase in bullying? Has there been any?
I haven't heard of any, and again, I go back to the principals and to the school districts. I mean, that's where you're going to see real change. The education system is kind of decentralized in this state, and where policy is really made is on the level of each school, and you see some principals really advocating inclusion and involving all kids in extracurricular activities, and so it's kind of a unifying message, and that's where you're going to see the real change here.
That's Andy Miller, editor for Georgia Health News, and Belisa Urbina also joined us. She's executive director for Ser Familia. The Latino population in Georgia is growing, but schools cannot find enough Latino teachers. Fair Street Elementary in Gainesville is made up of roughly 60% Latino students, but only a handful of Latino teachers. Julio Cabañas is an assistant principal there at Fair Street Elementary and was also Gainesville's first Latino administrator. It's good to have you with us.
Good morning, Celeste. It's an honor to be here this morning.
Why is it important? I mean, having just heard this conversation about the uptick in bullying and how dangerous that is, why is it important then to have Latino teachers? Can they help with the problem we just heard about?
Absolutely. If you look at the background of the Latino teachers that we have, and as well as myself, we come from similar backgrounds of having immigrant parents. Most of us were born in this country. So we have that situation where you need to have those strong leaders and role models to be able to say that I have a voice in this situation. Being able to say I am proud of my heritage and I will speak up for myself is something that's important for our students. Luckily, we did not have the strong boom right after the election of students to be scared and wanting to go. There were a handful of students, but our administrative team immediately got on that and started saying the importance of inclusion of all our students and being proud of who you are and not to worry about those situations. Your main focus is just to continue to work on school and to continue to improve yourself as a person, not to worry about the outside situations that really the children had no control over.
So why is it so difficult? And this difficulty in finding Latino teachers is statewide, anywhere that we have a large population of Latino and Latina kids. So why is it so difficult to recruit these teachers?
It's not necessarily that it's a difficult thing. It's just maybe possibly a situation of opportunity. I am blessed to work in a school system where we are 65% Hispanic as a district. Our school, as a matter of fact, our district, we have the highest in the entire state of English language learners at 32%. Being able to come to a situation where you have the opportunity to be a voice and to move forward is important. Gainesville City Schools has a great working relationship with two universities, the University of North Georgia and Brunel University, trying to work to recruit more Hispanic administrators and Hispanic teachers for that purpose, to have the future set up for our students as our community continues to grow in diversity as it does.
What are the strategies you think? I mean, I've heard that and I've read that universities in their training programs can actually make a huge difference in who actually ends up going into teaching. But specifically, how does that work? What are the programs that actually are effective?
It's just a matter of, you know, for the students to understand the communities that they're working with, to be able to go out in a community-based situation. We as a school, as Fair Street, are very much community-based. Our teachers know that they have the voice to speak to the parents. The parents are always included in any situations we make. It's a great feeling for a parent to call in and they're concerned with the first question they ask is, you know, ¿hablas español? And when you can answer yes, just the comfort level, making them feel more comfortable of calling the school, of being able to participate is a big thing. Just basically, as long as the teachers know that...
I want to stop you for just a moment,
sure.
I think often that when we think about why it's important to have Latino teachers, we think about them being bilingual and speaking to the students. You're saying it's even more important that they're able to speak to the parents.
That's the first thing. The first step is community involvement, because once you get the parents involved, the students are happier to have that situation. And when a student is able to know that their parent can call in for a positive situation and the administration or the teachers can communicate back, it makes the student happier to focus on their grades, to focus on attendance, which is the main thing. I mean, a lot of the Hispanic parents, if they feel, you know, their student needs to stay home for a certain amount of time, or they think that, you know, I can take them out of school for 2 months to go down to Mexico or wherever, they need to understand, you know, there's ramifications for that. The student needs to stay in school, needs to stay on that track. We can't be so lackadaisical of saying, all right, they could take 2 months off and they'll just jump back into it. 2 months of schooling is a long time. So the importance of attendance, behavior, and classroom performance are a big focus we have in our district.
How involved are you with all the students? I mean, how involved is an assistant principal to become in their daily classroom lives?
I mean, I was on it from the moment when it started. I left a different district, but immediately when I met the superintendent at the time, Dr. Creel, her focus and vision on One Gainesville and moving forward absolutely just enamored me, and I had to be in there. The next thing I did was I looked at the pictures of our school board. And immediately, just the diversity of our school board in itself, there's Caucasian, African American, and Hispanic leaders, shows that they are leading towards community involvement. Every day within the system, I speak to parents, we're out there, the administrative team, just for the students to know we have two minority leaders in our school, the principal and myself. You know, he's an African American male, I'm a Hispanic male. Just having that opportunity for the students to see, wow, these are great leaders who look like me, who have the same similar background of me, just makes it happier and a better situation every day.
And then how does that change then the educational outcomes for the kids? I mean, they're all still learning the same curriculum. So how does the diversity of the school board and the administrative staff have an effect?
It really does, because it makes you more proud of the heritage you are, regardless if you're a Cuban background, if you're Mexican, if you're El Salvadorian, just knowing that there is a great opportunity here for me in the future. I can be a teacher. Teachers lead everything, or I can be a police officer. I can be a fireman. The main important part is, no matter what you have in front of a Cuban, African-American, the main part is the second part of the word, which is American, which is what we all are, and our focus is the students and getting to work together.
But as I'm sure you're aware, there's a shortage of teachers, period.
Very much so.
It doesn't matter
regardless of the situation.
Regardless of background, we're having trouble in America and also in Georgia in recruiting teachers.
Yep.
So can you give me your best pitch? What's your best pitch for me as a college student to become a teacher?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, and I say that because we also need, you know, strong male role models in the elementary school as well. Teaching is the foundation for everything, whether it's being a police officer, whether it's being a firefighter, whether it's being president. All of those people were taught by, of course, educators. And we all have that one teacher or two or three and hopefully more where you can say, I went into this field because of that person. Just having someone that you know is there who cares for you every day, it's basically just like having an additional parent. We are there with these students for most of the part time, more than their own families in itself. So for them to have that caring feeling, for a teacher to know my opinion is valued, my work ethic is valued, that's the main thing. Allowing all the teachers to have their own style and to do what they need to do, then manage their own classrooms, but no, our main funnel down is to get our students to improve in every aspect of the day.
What else needs to happen? If you were going to have the power to change one thing in education that might especially impact kids of diverse mm-hmm. backgrounds, what would that be?
I would just hope that more opportunities given. I mean, for more Hispanic leaders to do that, to be given those opportunities to run a school. I'm more than capable of running a school right now, and I'm excited for it. But the situation where I'm in right now, being able to take a school like we have this past year and just show that regardless of we're 60% Hispanic, 25% African-American, those schools can compete with just as well as students in schools that are 2% diverse. It's just a matter of the curriculum is going to be the same. It's how you teach it and how you move forward and be proud of your own self and heritage.
That's Julio Cabañas. He's assistant principal at Fair Street Elementary in Gainesville. Julio, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's our show for today, but we always welcome your thoughts. What kind of diversity do you see in your kids' school, or if you're a kid, in your own school, and how does it affect your kids when that teacher has a diverse background? You can let us know your thoughts at 404-500-9457. Leave us a message. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPBB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.